Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The $20 billion fund set up to compensate victims of the Gulf oil disaster begins operating today. Kenneth Feinberg, the man who runs the Gulf Coast Claims Facility and who also administered the 9/11 Victims Fund, told reporters in a conference call yesterday that he's going to be more generous than any court would be if victims pressed their own lawsuits against BP.
It is not in your interest to tie up you and the courts in years of uncertain, protracted litigation when there is an alternative that has been created.
But Feinberg admits he's going to have to draw some pretty tough lines. For instance, some hotels might have a difficult case to prove. And if you accept a final settlement from the fund, victims must give up their right to sue BP, but they may be able to sue other companies. Joining us on the line from Washington to explain the rules of the fund is Jim Snyder. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News. And Jim, first of all, remind us how the fund came into existence.
Well, BP set up a $20 billion escrow account to avoid protracted litigation. They'd rather handle these claims with this claims facility than fight these various claims in court. And the fund itself kind of grew out of negotiations between the company and the Obama administration.
BP has already paid out $375 million. Is that part of the $20 billion fund? And will those people who've received that money still be able to sue?
They will be able to sue, yeah, and that money is not part of the $20 billion fund. The $20 billion fund works in two parts. The first part, which will last 90 days, people can apply for emergency payments for 1 to 6 months worth of compensation. Then after November 23rd, Mr. Feinberg starts administering final claims. It's only when a claimant accepts a final payment that he waives his or her right to sue BP.
This has all been the subject of negotiations between Feinberg and BP and other companies. Transocean operated the rig, and Anadarko Petroleum held a 25% stake in the well. Is Feinberg making the final decisions here, or is he operating under guidelines set by President Obama, who back in June accused BP of nickel and diming people in the Gulf?
Mr. Feinberg says that he's totally independent. The facility that he's running is totally independent. It's not beholden, as he often says, to either BP or the administration.
So he's judge and jury. Now, what are the criteria? Who can file a claim, and where does it get hard to decide?
Any business that suffered a financial loss or some other impact from the spill can file a claim. Mr. Feinberg says that proximity to the Gulf will be one of his determining factors on whether a claim is eligible. Another factor will be the type of business that the person is operating and how dependent it is on the natural resources of the Gulf Coast, including the beach. Hotels and restaurants and other businesses along Florida's western coast, which is on the Gulf of Mexico but isn't on the panhandle part that actually was impacted directly by the spill, are some claims that could prove problematic. They say that they've suffered from a decline in tourism, not because, again, their beaches have been damaged, but because of a misperception that all of Florida was impacted by the spill. Mr. Feinberg says that tourism claims like these are going to be particularly hard to judge.
So a hotel on the beach in Louisiana with tar balls on their beach has a claim. That's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But a hotel not directly affected, maybe further inland or maybe a mini golf course, what do you say, 10 miles away, but says tourism's down and we've lost money. Will that be more difficult?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Mr. Feinberg says you could be a hotel on the beach. Even if your beach is pristine, you probably have a compensable claim if you can show that your business has been damaged by a misperception. But you're right. These businesses that are a little bit removed from the beach, whether they've had oil there or not, could be tricky to administer.
But you point out that the Republican Attorney General of Florida is criticizing Feinberg for establishing too high a burden of proof. What does he say about that?
Well, Mr. Feinberg says that that's not accurate, that he's going to be more generous than the state law would allow or the federal law under the Oil Pollution Act would allow. So he's going to take a more liberal view of who's eligible for claims than he says the law requires.
There are other complaints, too. Shrimpers are saying they're unhappy with the plan that would deduct what they've earned from cleaning up the spill from their final settlement. Why would that be allowed? I mean, isn't that work versus damages?
Well, I mean, from BP's perspective, they are keeping these guys employed during a time when they couldn't fish or they couldn't shrimp, and therefore that counts against their final claim.
Jim Snyder, thank you very much for talking with us about it today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Jim Snyder with Bloomberg News. In 2003, after the U.S.-led invasion, Manal Omar went to Iraq to run the operations of Women for Women International, an NGO that supports women in war-torn areas. She left in 2005 when the country became too dangerous.
I have worked in other conflict-torn countries, but my time in Iraq haunts me more than any place I have been. I am unable to put the experiences behind me. It maddens me that so many of the mistakes that pushed Iraq into chaos were avoidable. And I have a profound sense of guilt when I think of all the women whose cases I was never able to close. When I fled Iraq, I also fled from them, and I can't help but feel that I left them stranded.
Manal Omar's book is Barefoot in Baghdad, A Story of Identity, My Own and What It Means to Be a Woman in Chaos. She's now director of Iraq programs at the United States Institute of Peace. And Manal Omar joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The title of your book comes from an Iraqi Turkmen proverb. Tell us about it.
The proverb is that if you walk barefoot, the thorns will hurt you. And I often heard that from women in Iraq in terms of the idea of working on women's issues. You're going to get hurt. You're going to have to go out of societal norms, and you're going to have to make challenges which are going to lead to more difficult situations.
And you really stepped on some thorns when you went to Baghdad.
Like they warned me, dealing with women's issues was much more difficult than dealing with other humanitarian issues like food security or building houses.
Why is that?
Well, women's issues is very ingrained in the social fabric of society, and particularly after conflict. There are a lot of opportunities that open for change, but at the same time, there's a stronger desperation to hold on to more tribal or traditional customs.
This is really, though, a story of identity. You, an American aid worker of Arab descent, what drew you to work in Iraq in this field of international aid after growing up in Texas?
Iraq had been the first country that I had been exposed to as an Arab American, and I had initially worked with the United Nations in Iraq in 1997. In 1998. And I fell in love with the country right away. I mean, every corner has culture, has art, has tradition in a very beautiful and modern way, you know, very contemporary intellectuals. And when I heard about the war in Iraq, I had been in Afghanistan, and I knew that this was an opportunity to go back to Iraq and to possibly assist in the rebuilding of the country.
You say in the book that your multicultural identity, a Palestinian and a Southerner, a Muslim and a woman, was your secret superpower. What's that allowed you to do?
I felt that my different identities would allow me to relate to different people in Iraq. And indeed, that was a big opportunity for me, particularly early on in Iraq. I was able to go and, you know, relate to the soldiers, most of them who were from the south, you know, talk about the best beaches and, you know, get through the checkpoints. At the same time, I was, you know, as an Arabic speaker, I was able to meet with women in the most vulnerable and marginalized areas. And I was able to transfer their voices to the decision makers. At that time, were primarily U.S. people from the State Department and the Pentagon. So, you know, bridging those different viewpoints was something that my identity allowed me to tap into.
But didn't the Iraqis see you as a Westerner?
That was one of the things that happened that I hadn't anticipated, that, you know, although I was very confident in this multi-identity, a lot of people were not comfortable with that. People felt that I needed to choose sides or needed to choose one identity and stick to it. And, you know, there was this debate that an identity was mutually exclusive from the other. And essentially, the Iraqis actually didn't view me as much as a Westerner. I think that my age and my Palestinian identity was highlighted first. And then the fact that I was a veiled woman was highlighted second. So there was almost a questioning, are you really a Westerner? Are you really American? And it was ironic that, you know, my patriotism to America was challenged mostly in Iraq than it had ever been in Texas or South Carolina.
And some people saw you as an extremist.
That's correct. There was a lot of people who felt, you know, as a veiled woman, you know, who chose to wear the scarf in America, why was I coming to Iraq to make, you know, to work with women's issues? What was my agenda?
And you also tried to walk the line between the U.S.-led coalition and the Iraqi government. You didn't want to take sides, but at times you had to get something done. Can you tell me about one of these instances? You retell many of the cases that you worked with Women for Women International in Iraq, but tell me about the time you tried to get help for the two sisters who were brutally raped.
This was a particularly challenging story. There were two sisters who had been raped. It was in the beginning, early 2003. It was an indication that there was no police on the streets, and these girls had been taken from their home. It was a, almost a revenge crime. The older sister, her neighbor had proposed to her under Saddam, and you know, she was a very young girl. She was only 14, and her mother decided that she didn't want to have her married. So right after the war, they came in and they took both sisters by force, and you know, they were both brutally raped. One of the difficulties was, once the case came to me, was, you know, how do we protect these girls? And you know, the first obviously response that I had was I wanted to find local organizations that would support these girls and that would be able to provide them both the emotional support they needed, but also some of the protection. It came as a little bit of a surprise to me when most of the organizations were saying that they couldn't handle rape cases.
They wouldn't even touch the girls because they were too concerned about the repercussions for themselves?
That is exactly the situation. That was the case, is that they felt that by handling these cases, it would bring a negative reputation on the women's organizations, that the type of women that they support, you know, they wanted to be able to support women who were widows, women who were, unmarried, you know, what they would call women with clean reputations. Whereas helping with rape cases has a social stigma that these organizations, and again, keeping in mind that civil society was very new in Iraq at that time, they felt they would be vulnerable to people accusing them of harboring women that, you know, whose reputations would be questionable.
So what happened to the girls?
What we did in the beginning was we tried to enroll them in Women for Women International's program, particularly the older daughter. We helped her with job skills training and providing livelihood, and we also tried to open her up to a community of women that would be able to provide her emotional support. However, over time, the protection issues began to become much greater than something that Women for Women International could respond to, and the mother became fearful. Finally, she packed up and she left Baghdad. She decided that it wasn't safe enough for her and her girls.
And personally, you ended up falling in love with one of the Iraqi men you worked with, Youssef, and you get married. But you write that your wedding day was the worst single day of your life. What happened?
That's correct. I think for a very long time, you know, working with women in Iraq had become part of the periphery. Although, obviously, I did fall in love with someone that I worked with and got to know his family. Again, it was always, you know, another person that I was helping. But on the day of our wedding, his brother-in-law was killed in Iraq. And it brought the reality that now I was going to be part of this society that was a war-torn society that suffered such tragedies that impacted every part of their lives. And no other greater way to do it than on our wedding day brought home that reality.
So your wedding is always going to be tied with his death.
That's correct. Every year we have the mourning of his passing away, and our wedding anniversary just kind of slips into the background.
That's Manal Omar. Her book is Barefoot in Baghdad. After a break, hopes for the future for Iraq's women. Back in a minute. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Manal Omar. From 2003 to 2005, she was the director of Women for Women International in Iraq, working with Iraqi women in the aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion. Her memoir is called Barefoot in Baghdad, a story of identity, my own, and what it means to be a woman in chaos. And Manal, before the break, you spoke of trying to help two girls who'd been brutally raped, but ultimately that effort failed, and one of the reasons was the cultural stigma of rape in Iraq. But I know from reading the book, there were also success stories.
Definitely. There are a lot of success stories from the women. I mean, one of the things that is amazing about Iraqi women and something that I took away from was their insistence on surviving and being optimistic. And a lot of the women that we worked with, particularly the ones that we offered job skills training, were able to go on and start their own small businesses, were able to develop incomes, became decision makers in their own home and some in their own community. For example, a woman that I helped in Karbala had become part of the program, and after a year and a half, she actually ran for office in the provincial council. Again, this is a woman who started off very marginalized, very vulnerable, who wasn't even able to get her younger sons to listen to her, but after a year and a half in the program, had found her own voice, was able to assert it in the household, and then decided that she was going to run for office, and she won in the provincial council elections.
In your work, you came into contact with American officials, and I would describe your interactions with them as mixed. How would you characterize them?
I think it was mixed. I mean, initially, I had very strong reservations. I had very strong opinions about the war. And it took some, self-check when I arrived into Iraq to actually listen to what Iraqis were thinking and what Iraqis wanted. And so there was a little bit of a reluctance in a lot of my interactions, particularly because of the debates on separating civilian and military activities, particularly in the humanitarian sphere, which is the background that I come from as an aid worker. However, as I became more desperate and realized that the U.S. was, although not legally required, performing the role of duty bearer, there was a need to reach out. And I would say that the first years, I mean, Iraq each year was a completely different year. The first years, particularly 2003 and 2004, there was a very strong eagerness to help, to make change. I always say that there was almost a shift between 2004 to 2005 between an army of liberation to an army of occupation. By 2005, people at the checkpoints were much more nervous. You could tell that there was a lot of soldiers who didn't want to be there. It was a very different flavor, and that also changed the level of interactions that I had with the U.S. military.
So what do you think that says about the American legacy in Iraq? You write that the legacy of the United States could leave behind would be through Iraqi women, and that women should be used as a barometer of success inside Iraq. Why is that?
I think that we have seen that women tend to be more open to change. Women are more eager to improve the lives of the future generation. They see that the importance of investing in their youth, and that they're really looking for the basic services and stability. The biggest challenge now remains in terms of legacy is how we will be able to continue to support Iraq. Iraqi women early on in 2003 were talking about leaping forward. They really believed that a window of opportunity had been opened where they would be able to secure their rights, rights that were initially guaranteed to them in the 1960s and in the 1970s. However, now there is a very strong sense that they will be lucky if they just maintain the status quo.
Yeah, because you write about that window of opportunity and how it can come into conflict with Islamic beliefs about women, and that those values can come to clash with Sharia law, for instance. It sounds as if you are concerned about the future rights of women in Iraq.
I think that there is a concern in terms of a very monolithic interpretation of Islamic law. When you don't open the debate to something that's much stronger and being able to discuss what type of Islam, what Islamic law, how that will be applied to women, and you make it a simple debate between Islam and secularism, I think you lose the depth and the colorful discussion that could happen, which would guarantee women's rights. Unfortunately, I feel that is the way that we moved in Iraq. We made it a very simple discussion. Do you want secularism or do you want Islamic law? Without talking about the different versions of Islamic law and ways that Islamic law can secure women's rights. And what we ended up with was polarizing women's issues and polarizing the country between the two extremes.
So they're not mutually exclusive.
Not at all. In fact, if you look at countries like Morocco, they've been able to really guarantee very advanced and very contemporary women's rights, all using an Islamic framework. Unfortunately, that level of discussion never happened in Iraq. Although now with the program that we're working with the United States Institute of Peace, we are beginning to bring these two groups, the secular and the polarized groups, together to start such discussions.
And what about the work of Women for Women International, where the group you went to Iraq with, does that work go on?
That work goes on, and I'm very happy to say that the office and a lot of the staff that I worked with in 2003 are still working very hard to make changes for Iraqi women. And they're primarily doing that by trying to secure livelihoods, which is an essential part, particularly when you look at the large number of widows inside Iraq.
In the end, Manal, what does it all add up to for you? Your story, the work you did in Iraq, the friendships, the people you helped. What does that experience leave you going forward in your life as you continue to work to help people in Iraq?
I feel very tied to Iraq, not only because I have an Iraqi husband and Iraqi family, but because it taught me a lot. My experience in Iraq taught me that despite despair, despite tragedy, there is a way to be cautiously optimistic. There is a way to continue to work towards the future and not allow the difficulties to drown you. And I think that that type of lesson is something that I found to be very important personally, and I feel indebted to that exposure in Iraq. At the same time, having worked on Iraq for 7 years, I feel that there are lessons learned that I have experienced, particularly being on the ground for so long, and I'm eager to share those lessons, not only with Iraqi women, but looking forward to our work in Afghanistan, how we can make sure to bridge those lessons learned between Iraq and Afghanistan, and particularly between Afghan women and Iraqi women, letting them learn from the pitfalls and the successes that they've experienced.
Will you go back to Iraq?
I go back to Iraq every few months and can, you know, hope to have a job that will continue to allow me to do so.
That's Manal Omar. Her book is Barefoot in Baghdad, A Story of Identity, My Own and What It Means to Be a Woman in Chaos. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Manal Omar is now Director of Iraq Programs for the United States Institute of Peace. You can read an excerpt from Barefoot in Baghdad at hereandnow.org. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Florida voters are preparing to decide two heated primary battles tomorrow. U.S. Representative Kendrick Meek and billionaire businessman Jeff Green are vying for the Democratic nomination to the U.S. Senate. It's a contentious race that's been more about character than policy. And in another bitter primary contest, State Attorney General Bill McCollum and wealthy former health care executive Rick Scott seek the Republican gubernatorial nomination. Joining us from Florida is Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. And Adam, let's start with the Senate primary. We've got a billionaire in Jeff Green who's pouring a ton of his own money into the race, and Kendrick Meek telling Green during a televised debate, "I have more integrity in my pinky than you have in your whole body." So just tick off some of the things Meek's talking about there.
You know, these guys do not differ very much on the issues. It really boils down to character. And Kendrick Meek is suggesting Jeff Green, the billionaire, has made his money off of subprime mortgage implosions and hedged his bets on real estate by investing in these credit default swaps. So he made a lot of money as people defaulted their subprime mortgages, but he argues that it's a case of him seeing what, unfortunately, too many people in Washington and Wall Street didn't see, that the housing bubble was going to burst. But I think between that and a lot of these other issues, whether it's, you know, a yacht that damaged a coral reef in Belize and Green saying sort of unbelievably that nothing of the kind happened, to taking his yacht to Cuba and giving various explanations for why it happened, for having to explain his close friendship with Mike Tyson and answer questions about crazy drug sex parties allegedly on his boat. You know, it's a little more colorful than Florida is accustomed to voting for.
All of that and the recent polls show it's a pretty tight race.
Yeah, it's a pretty tight race. I think initially, though, a lot of people said, given the amount of money that Jeff Green was capable and started spending, a lot of people thought Meek was doomed, and it turned out to not be the case, in large part because there was a comfort level that Jeff Green apparently just couldn't get with the voters.
And looking ahead to November, we've got Republican Marco Rubio. He's the Tea Party favorite who's expected to easily win the GOP nomination tomorrow. And Governor Charlie Crist, who's running as an independent because he left the Republican Party earlier this year because Rubio was just so far ahead in the polls. Is there any way to say at this point how the general election will shake out, whether Meek wins or Green wins tomorrow?
Well, I would say conventional wisdom would have it that if Jeff Green wins the nomination, that's a lot better for Charlie Crist, the independent candidate, than if Meek wins the nomination, because Meek has, you know, a lot of establishment support in the Democratic Party, and it's going to be difficult for a lot of prominent Democrats and money people and whatnot to get behind Charlie Crist and snub Kendrick Meek. It wouldn't be so difficult for them, I think, politically to snub Jeff Green.
Let's jump over to the governor's race now. We've got a state attorney general, Bill McCollum, and the wealthy Rick Scott, who, like Jeff Green, has spent millions of his own money on his campaign, upwards of $40 million already. Give us the highlights there.
Well, again, it's kind of a character issue. Bill McCollum, the attorney general, is sort of the quintessential career politician. So Rick Scott started putting a lot of money, like twice as much money as Jeff Green, on TV, which matters a great deal in Florida, and very quickly took a big lead in the polls. And then it came down to, you know, the old truism that a lot of voters don't make up their minds until the last few weeks seems to be the case here, that ultimately there was a lot of undecided voters, and then they looked at Rick Scott's background, which was head of a hospital chain, Columbia HCA, that was had to pay the biggest fine in history for Medicare fraud, $1.7 billion.
And then we head into the general election, where the state CFO, Alex Sink, a woman, is expected to win the Democratic nomination tomorrow. Any sense of how she might fare against either McCollum or Scott come November?
Well, I will say, you know, the White House is a lot more interested in the outcome of our governor's race than it is in our Senate race. The governor's race, really, what happens there can really have a big effect on 2012. So we've had this bruising primary between Bill McCollum and Rick Scott for the Republican nomination, and Bill McCollum is now virtually broke. Both of them have driven up their negatives sky high. So you've got Alex Sink right now looking like a very serious contender to win the governor's mansion.
Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times in St. Petersburg, Florida. Thanks so much.
Sure thing.
And this note about a primary in Arizona. Ben Quayle, son of Dan Quayle, is running for Congress, but his lead shrunk in part because of a campaign mailing that featured a picture of the 33-year-old holding two young girls, giving the impression that he's a family man. But the kids were his nieces, something not mentioned on the flyer. Back in a bit, here and now. Welcome back. Supermodel Naomi Campbell was called as a witness at the war crimes trial of former Liberian strongman Charles Taylor. So was Mia Farrow. But what about Pat Robertson? Why wasn't he called? Robertson is founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network. He was a one-time Republican presidential candidate, and he was also the owner of a gold mine in Liberia during Taylor's rule. Investigative reporter Aram Rostin writes about the ties between the two men in The Nation magazine. To read his story, go to our website, hereandnow.org, and Aram joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Monica.
Aram, can you start by chronicling for us, when did Pat Robertson first get involved in African business ventures, and what were they?
Early on in the 90s, he became, as far as I know, the first venture he had was in Zaire. What drew him in initially was sort of missionary and aid work, where he had this huge, well, supposedly huge operation called Operation Blessing to help people in war-ravaged Zaire. But he became very intrigued in diamond mining, and he got a diamond mining concession offered him by the dictator of Zaire, Mobutu, who you'll recall was, you know, widely seen as an American puppet and a kleptocrat. So this is where Pat Robertson began getting very, very intrigued by the idea of making money on the diamond trade. And the scandal was that his planes, he had some planes that were basically purchased and funded by charitable donations. But instead of working on the charity there in Zaire, the planes were ferrying supplies back and forth to the diamond mine.
Now, how did he end up then with ties to Charles Taylor?
I think maybe what initially brought him there is missionary work, but what really got him involved in business in Liberia was another American who had been running this, prospecting this gold mine called Bukangida for years. He was an older American named Ken Ross, and he had tried to dig for gold under a successive, you know, regimes in Liberia, and he needed funding. He actually had met with Charles Taylor, and he told me back when I was doing the story that Charles Taylor first mentioned Pat Robertson to him, to the American, so as a possible financier. Later, this man, this American, this miner, met with Pat Robertson in Virginia. He said he told Pat Robertson how much this gold mine could be worth. His estimate was that the amount of gold would be worth $2.5 billion. And he said Pat Robertson seemed really interested. They met over at the headquarters of the Christian Broadcast Network. And later, somehow Pat Robertson, not this other miner, ended up with the concession, signed personally by Charles Taylor.
And does Charles Taylor acknowledge a relationship to Robertson?
He does. I mean, Charles Taylor, first of all, he was asked about this in some testimony at The Hague back in February by the prosecutors. And he said his understanding was that, that Pat Robertson would be sort of representing him in Washington. He was trying to gain influence in Washington using Pat Robertson. Now, Pat Robertson says he, of course, had nothing to do with this, but certainly this is what Charles Taylor had admitted to. What I put on the web now was the actual agreement, the mining agreement, the mineral development agreement between Pat Robertson and Charles Taylor. Pat Robertson's company then was called Freedom Gold. It was registered in the Cayman Islands, and Pat Robertson was the president. And his signature is there on the page, as is the signature of Charles Taylor.
So there seems to be some truth to what Taylor believed, that Robertson would be acting, promoting him or acting on his behalf in some way in Washington, wasn't there?
Yes, but here's the thing. It is true that Pat Robertson actively promoted Charles Taylor and his despotic rule in Liberia in the late 90s and in the last decade as well. Pat Robertson would go on a TV show and he would get involved in this really obscure issue of Liberian politics. You know, why would that be an issue for him? Well, he said it was because of issues of Christianity, and he felt Christians would be under threat if Charles Taylor was toppled. Pat Robertson said he wasn't sponsoring or representing Charles Taylor in any way because of the gold mine. But it's clear Charles Taylor thought he was, and it's clear Pat Robertson did speak on his behalf quite openly.
Well, now with this trial going on, has Robertson made any comment about it, especially since there are some activists saying that Robertson himself should be called to testify?
Robertson himself has not talked publicly about it recently, but his spokesman did tell me there was no quid pro quo and claimed the main issue, it's sort of strange interpretation of African politics at the time, was that Robertson was defending Taylor publicly because he didn't want the government of Guinea, a neighboring country, to somehow invade with Muslim extremists who might threaten the Christians in Liberia. So that was his nominal excuse for being so vocal in defense of Charles Taylor, who is widely believed to be a war criminal and was widely believed to be a war criminal.
Well, do you think Robertson should be called to testify?
You know, I don't know what I would be fascinated to hear him under oath. It would be stunning. It would be extraordinary. And I think it would open a lot of people's eyes. And it's maybe the only way to really learn the truth. The downside is, in this case, I don't know if it's directly relevant to this case. The charges against Charles Taylor are that he accepted so-called blood diamonds from these brutal rebels, the RUF, known for chopping people's hands off as policy, accepted blood diamonds and then in return sold them arms and sponsored them, thus fueling this awful war. He was, in essence, responsible for that civil war that claimed so many lives in Sierra Leone. I don't know that there's a direct link, except that keeping Charles Taylor in power helped the civil war in neighboring Sierra Leone continue. But there wasn't this issue of blood diamonds that shows up in the Pat Robertson case.
Or with the gold mine that he owned in Liberia.
Well, to me, just the astonishing thing is the idea that Pat Robertson would deal with him, ignoring the entire world's sort of view on Charles Taylor, what everybody in Africa knew to be true. Charles Taylor was trained by Gaddafi. He had escaped from a U.S. prison. He had invaded Liberia in 1989. There were issues of sanctions and so forth. And yet Pat Robertson, this televangelist, was so willing to go into business with him with this idea that there would be $2.5 billion worth of gold to be discovered.
A very interesting business partnership. Aram Rostin's article on this partnership, the ties between evangelist Pat Robertson and deposed Liberian warlord Charles Taylor, appears in The Nation. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Monica.
And this note about two stories in the news. The UN says floodwaters are outrunning relief efforts in Pakistan, that no matter how quickly relief workers try to hold back the waters, the finish line keeps moving ahead. Officials say workers are desperately trying to shore up levees protecting two southern cities in Pakistan, and if that doesn't work, the water will flood more towns further south. And American International Group, or AIG, says it's paying back the federal government nearly $4 billion in loans. It sold its aircraft leasing company to pay the debt. AIG still owes $15 billion on its line of credit with the Federal Reserve Bank. Overall, AIG received $180 billion in federal bailout money. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. And you're about to go on vacation, or maybe you just got back from one. We want to see the photographs, not the serious ones showing you deeply pondering nature at Yellowstone Park. No, no, no. We want the tacky ones, the ones of you hugging George Clooney. The wax version, that is, or the one where you're holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Why do we take those kinds of photos? Well, at least they have a home on a new website, tackytouristphotos.com. You can find it and put up your own shots by going to our website, hereandnow.org. Two of the site's creators are with us, Darren Garnick and Ilya Merman. Darren, Ilya, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Darren, just to take the intellectual level down here and so that we're all on the same page. You say that some of these pictures happen when your 8-year-old son says to you, "Hey, Dad, that would make a great tacky tourist photo."
Absolutely. I mean, family road trips are all about, you know, searching for the world's largest ball of twine or the world's largest crayfish. And, my son is just as much into wacky photo opportunities as I am. And we bond a lot over who can take the craziest photo.
And you're not only inviting people to send in their photographs, you're also putting up your own. And Ilya, yours, I notice, are more international. Tell us about a couple of them.
When we were at the Eiffel Tower, I mean, that's an iconic landmark, and there's a million photos of it, some of which are tacky. And so we spent probably an hour there with some friends trying to think about all the different ways we could incorporate the Eiffel Tower. So it was a dunce hat. It was a leaning post for one of the taller guys on the trip. And we just had a lot of fun. There's a silhouette shot of somebody holding it daintily.
I've seen some of those myself.
And it was really neat because we did this not out of disrespect. We did it out of genuine enjoyment and love and just having fun and frolicking in Paris. And people really got into it. They were giving us ideas on ways to take the different shots. They were helping us clear because some of the vantage points required a lot of free space.
So they didn't think you were mocking the Eiffel Tower. They were cheering you on.
Exactly.
Let me go to you, Darren, and say, describe some of your favorites on the site.
So there's something I call the hole in the head, where you'll go into, it'll say, "Welcome to Cape Cod," and you'll stick your head inside the picture of a giant lobster or a giant mermaid. There's costume booths, like those old antique costume booths where you'll be like a knight or a Civil War hero or Anne of Green Gables.
Wait a second. I think you were dressed as Anne of Green Gables.
Yes, that is correct.
So you'll do anything for a tacky photo?
Well, the truth is I've been dressing as Anne of Green Gables for years, and that Tacky Tourist Photos is just, you know, a front to give it intellectual legitimacy. But no, I have become more daring and more courageous and a little bit more goofy since we started Tacky Tourist Photos. I honestly don't think I would have put on a green dress and braids if I wasn't doing this website. And, you know, we're willing to make fun of ourselves.
Darren, what really makes a photo tacky? Because when I look at these, one of my favorite is someone at the equator in Uganda spreading their arms out. They're on both sides of the equator. And I admit I've taken that photo of myself in Kenya. I didn't consider it tacky. I considered it, that's what you do at the equator.
Sure. We use the word tacky as a compliment. So really what we mean is goofy or funny or kitschy, people having fun with their vacation. However, what makes something tacky? I love the equator photos because here is a country taking advantage of an imaginary geographical line and saying, we can spin it, we can make it a tourist trap. You know, set up a souvenir shop and the imaginary line becomes a tourist attraction. And I'm the first one to leap right on that statue that says you are at the equator as well. And people love to do it. That's the thing.
And in fact, one thread that runs through all of the photos, I think, is that all of the people don't take themselves too seriously.
we really strive to distinguish ourselves by not making fun of the people in the photos. We're celebrating these photos with our fellow goofy tourists. There are a lot of websites out there that put up a funny picture and get a gazillion comments, but it's all mean-spirited stuff, and we are not that.
Yeah, because some of the photos I see could be interpreted as making fun of the culture as opposed to just a fun photo.
There are people out there that do adventure travel, that backpack, that they want to be where no other American tourists are, and they want to be where, you know, there's never been a Western fingerprint. And what we're saying is that there's a reason tourist traps are tourist traps. It's because they became popular because people like them. And so we're like the anti-snobs of travel. We say that just because something's a tourist trap doesn't mean that it's bad. It doesn't mean that it's not worth visiting. You can visit the tourist traps, have fun, and visit the out-of-the-way places in the world and enjoy those too.
And by the way, the word tacky also means something that sticks to you. And I think some of these images really stick to you. They stick to me, at least, when I see them. Or you've seen so many of them, somebody holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa, or, as you mentioned, putting your finger on top of the Eiffel Towers if you're as tall as it is. I'm wondering, though, for you, what are the ones you can't forget, Ilya, for better or for worse?
So one would be a friend of ours. We were walking through the streets of Istanbul, and there was a plumbing store, and it sold, among other things, toilet seats. And there was a fun display of toilet seats in this beautiful, 500-year-old street. And so she lifted the toilet seat, and we call it the toilet seat ventriloquist on the site. To me, the most fun pictures are where people really get into it. So anybody can pose with a Paul Revere statue, but I think the best photos are ones where the people really commit to the role and express an emotion. And so, for example, in the toilet seat ventriloquist, the eyes are quite expressive, and the mouth is mouthing in the same shape that the toilet seat that's being raised.
And what about for you, Darren?
The website for us is not just about things and places. It's about the magic that happens when the tourist interacts with the location. So my favorite photo, I call it military make-believe, and it's a Pittsburgh woman who was hiking through Ecuador, bumped into these soldiers from the Ecuadorian Special Forces, and then started posing with their helmet and their army jacket and their grenade launcher. And the reason why I love that photo is if you and I just wanted to invade Ecuador and take it over and take over their natural resources, we would just need an army of 50 pretty college co-eds, and it's done.
You can find that photo and take a look on your website, which you can access through hereandnow.org. And I'm just tempted that I've got to add a few photos from my recent vacation. And one I remember, my sister raising a glass in wine country, and then I realized the fountain behind it. If she just moved the glass a little bit more, it looked as if the fountain was pouring into the wine glass. I think that would qualify, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Or
send
maybe the talking lobster just before you eat it.
I think it's a fun moment of discovery, just like when a scientist discovers something in the lab that heretofore unthought of, the moment you think, oh, this is an opportunity for a photo.
We're hoping that people will raid their family photo albums and go through their childhoods. And I have this favorite photo of my parents torturing my siblings and I at the stockades in Plymouth where the Pilgrims were tortured.
I think I have a similar photo in my family album.
We'd also love to connect with a museum that doesn't take itself too seriously and do a tacky tourist photo exhibit.
Emmy-nominated filmmaker Darren Garnick and musician and photographer Ilya Merman. They are part of a team that's put together the website Tacky Tourist Photos, tacky places, tacky poses, tacky things. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We couldn't resist playing Holiday Road from the tackiest summer vacation ever, Chevy Chase and the gang in National Lampoon's Vacation. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.